Good afternoon and welcome to Take 5. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And today Cindy and I are going to be talking about heading on vacation. We're in the middle of summertime and fun food and wine destination. Cindy's just back from hers. And also about five American classic dishes. Fried chicken, crab cakes, because we are here in Maryland. Making pies, nobody seems to get it done well. Macaroni and cheese. And potato salad. We're going to try to lighten up the classics with a potato salad. We're going to talk about what's going on in the market, a few wines to play with the dishes, and all of this and a bit more coming up on Take 5.
Welcome back to Take 5. I'm Cindy Wolf.
And I'm Tony Foreman.
And we're here to talk about food and all American food in particular.
Let's talk about what Cindy's excited about.
Yes, my trip.
Vacation. We're at that time of the year, Cindy Lou.
Yes.
So where'd you go?
I was in France. Big surprise. And
you weren't there to like eat and drink.
No, not at all. No. It was all about torture and everything. But yes, no, had some amazing food and managed to find a couple of restaurants in Paris that were new to me and very, very exciting to go to.
All right, so here comes the Take 5 quiz. Give me your five favorite restaurants in Paris right now.
All right. Benoit, Chez Georges, La Serre, Table de Lancaster, and Le Verlet, Louis XIII. And those were five that I went to on this past trip and managed to eat at Benoit three times because the food was...
I managed to eat there just to see if they would get something right.
No, they were...
Good job.
So, they were right every single time from start to finish. The food was very, very good. Some time ago, Alain Ducasse took over the restaurant and it's as good as it's ever been right now. You know, been eating there for almost 20 years and it's a great bistro, and it really has a great feeling of a bistro, and it has a lot of good history to it.
Well, Benoit was a family place from like 1904 or 5 or something like that, right? So very Belle Epoque the way it feels inside.
Exactly. Lots of glass and brass and beautiful tile floor and, you know, it's so small rooms.
What was your
very
favorite?
Intimate.
So Benoit spelled B-E-N-O-I-T, right? So and that's in the first arrondissement?
Arrondissements
in Paris are the neighborhoods, right?
Right, and it's on a walking street, so if you're taking a taxi or taking the metro to get there, you have to realize
you can
get
close.
Yeah, you can get close, but you're not going to be dropped off in front of the restaurant. You actually have to walk about maybe half a block to get to it from the street that they drop you off at.
So what was the dish that made you go back three times to see if they would get it right?
Well, I had to have the escargot three times.
Is that your favorite escargot?
It is the best escargot. The butter is absolutely perfect. It has a perfect level of fresh tarragon and parsley, and the garlic is not burned in it. It's just really sweet and gently flavored with garlic, and the white wine is perfect. Everything on the snails, the butter is perfectly in balance, and then the snails themselves are absolutely delicious.
And you said that what you notice is that the herbs still tasted fresh and the butter was not burned. So you think they're doing it in two steps?
I do.
Because these are escargot roasted in the shell, right?
They are in the shell.
So.
And then I think that they cook them in probably a little bit of butter first. And once the snails are nice and hot, knock out that fat and put some fresh butter in, because it really does have a beautiful color to it. And that's not typically when you heat snails in the oven, you have to do it at really high heat.
And then, okay, so that was a favorite. Chez Georges is another bistro, right?
Oh, yes, and that's a more rustic bistro, and the service is a little bit more rustic. You know, at Benoit, they were even doing the chicken and the pig splatter, which is an amazingly, old-world dish.
No one ever likes how that sounds.
Yeah, no one likes the way.
I mean, I like how it sounds, because then, you know.
Because we know how good it is. The chicken is so
most food sounds much nicer in French, but.
How do you say it in French? I don't know what it's called in French, actually.
I've got to think about it.
Yeah, but that dish is so amazing because the chicken couldn't possibly be any more tender and amazing. So,
it steams inside of it.
It looks
like
it's in a little balloon. You know, it comes out into the dining room and it's blown up, and it's just what happens during the cooking process, and it's amazing. But that's the difference between Benoit and Chez Georges. Benoit is definitely sort of finer bistro food, if you will, and Chez Georges is just more traditional. Like their pork rillette is the best rillette I've ever had, and it's just just amazing, and they have great French baguette with it. And then one of the other dishes that they execute, their frisée salad. I mean, the frisée is amazing. It's just, you know, so bright. It's fresh. It's nice big pieces that have, you know, that are at the same time tender.
Frisée is always that thing, like when you first see it on a menu and you're a kid, and it looks like it's spelled frizzy.
Right. Well, it is kind of frizzy.
And exactly right. That's how it's sort of you know, bitter and bitter and crunchy.
Bitter in a good way.
Yeah, but bitter and kind of crunchy. And that's one of those flavors that people don't always appreciate right away.
And they also do at Chez George this big, huge, wonderful cut of turbo. They buy a big fish, and I typically buy a 5 to 7 pound fish. These are, you know, 25, 30 pound turbo. So you have this wonderful, it's called a tranche, which is just sort of a cross section of the fish, and it's this huge on the bone piece of turbo. Turbo is one of the, you know, sort of a sweet, large flaked, really delicate fish that has.
You usually think of turbo being almost like sole. Mm-hmm. This is a big one from the sea, and they grill it on the bone.
They do, and then they serve with hollandaise, and it's just, it's so good, and boiled potatoes, and it's just a very classic dish. And I love these two bistros so much.
And then the fancy places you mentioned were which?
La Serre, which is, again, a place that, you know, we've been going to for, you know, probably 15 years. And it is, they have a new chef, and the chef started about 2 years ago.
So La Serre is L-A-S-S-E-R-R-E.
Correct.
And that's that, it was a 3-star Michelin for a long time, like from the 20s and 30s, or I guess in the first guides, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. And it's still a 2-star Michelin restaurant now.
It is.
So it's a pretty pricey joint.
It is very pricey.
But it's an amazing room, no?
It is. The room is very Louis the 14th, I guess, and or somewhere around that time.
Very fancy. whatever Louis never makes you feel the fanciest.
There was a lot of gold, yeah. And just, oh my goodness, the room is gorgeous. And one of the really cool things about the room is it has a ceiling that opens up. And when we were there, the weather was absolutely perfect. It was like 70 degrees and a beautiful, clear night. And the wonderful thing about being in France at this time of the year is it's daylight until 10 o'clock at night this time of the year. So it's, you know, the days are long and it's just so beautiful. And, you know, you're sitting there in this very beautiful, fancy restaurant, and all of a sudden the ceiling just kind of rumbles and it opens and you're like, what's happening? And, oh, look, there's all this wonderful fresh air coming in and you can see the sky and birds fly by. And meanwhile, you're having this absolutely amazing French cuisine that is, you know, steeped in traditional cooking, but yet it's very modern, very fresh, and the chef is brilliant. I love Jean-Louis Nomikos, who was the chef before the current chef. He has since opened his own restaurant called Les Tablettes in Paris, very close to the Arc de Triomphe. And but the new chef at La Serre is really doing a great job, and the new maître d', Antoine Petrus, just an amazing gentleman and a fantastic maître d', and was so good to us. And we just had, we had an amazing time from service. I met the chef when I walked in, got to see their kitchen, was really excited to see that he had a couple of women working in his kitchen. So it was just, it was an amazing experience. I think we were there for, you know, because we spent the time. You don't have to be there for this period of time, but I think we were there for almost 5 hours. I mean, we had an amazing, amazing time.
And your other two big faves?
The two new restaurants, Table de Lancaster, used to be owned by one of the Trois-Cœurs brothers.
Sort of spelled like Table of Lancaster.
Correct. Right. And it's in the Hotel Lancaster, again, not too far from the Arc de Triomphe, so that neighborhood. And 6 months ago, I guess, I don't know if, I don't want to say exactly because I'm not certain, but I think Trois-Cœurs left, or else he sold it, or else there's a new chef. But there's a new chef.
So what was his best dish?
Oh, my goodness. He sent out a dish for us that was a gift, that was something he was going to be putting on the next night, which was fried frog's legs. And they were Frenched, so they looked like little bones with, you know, the meat in the form of a ball, basically.
Sort of tiny little drumsticks, kind of.
Oh, my goodness. They were perfection. And he had all these wonderful, he had a separate plate that had all this gorgeous garnish on it, a little bit of parsley puree, a little bit of tomato puree, just little drops on the plate that you could drag the little frog's legs through. Oh, my goodness. It was absolutely delicious. And we also had rouget.
Pretty rich little Mediterranean fish, no?
Yeah, and it's just so flavorful and beautiful. And I love that he coated it with a little bit of almost like a lemon gloss. And the fact that it was cold, I really can't believe how delicate the texture was. And it was just really pretty and sweet in your mouth for that sort of oily fish. And all the accompaniments on the plate were gorgeous. And then one of the other really amazing things, he was still doing one of Trois-Cœurs dishes, classic dishes from probably all the way back to the 50s, I would imagine, which is sole. And he had this perfectly fine layer of breadcrumb on top that was exactly a rectangle. And I mean, the whole dish was just perfectly executed, absolutely beautiful. And then the sauce is a fish fumet finished with cream and fresh chives. And it was just, it was so exciting to get to eat one of Monsieur Trochot's dishes that he was still executing this. And our service was amazing. And I can't help myself but to say that also the somme was a woman, which was, it was just, it's exciting to me to see that there are women in these restaurants. I mean, we've been eating there for 20 years and rarely see women in these restaurants.
And
so
a lot
really
of trips
cool.
to France and Spain, or France and Italy, I've not seen a female sommelier maybe once. And you know, in 20 years in Spain, I've seen it a number of times, mm-hmm. but that's in Basque Country or in Catalonia. They're a little more, you know, little less, I don't know, traditional. Let's say mm-hmm. about how they're going about their restaurants. But that's cool. I didn't say that before.
And then the last restaurant is Le Ray Louis 13th, and that is, I think it's close to the Saint Germain des Prés, or that neighborhood mm-hmm. is in that neighborhood, and it's a very old building. And you really feel that when you're in there. The rooms are small and very intimate and very sort of romantic.
So lots of little dining salons, sort of.
Mm-hmm. And the chef is just doing some brilliant classic dishes. The menu's not very big. There aren't that many choices, but what he has on his menu, everything we had the quenelle de brochette sauce nantua. That was the best execution I've ever had, which is, it's basically a very, very delicate seafood mousse and an old dish that's served with a crawfish or lobster and crawfish cream sauce. And it's sort of, the whole thing is put underneath a salamander gratinade on top, and the mousse was as perfect and light and flavorful as it could have been. And then we had the whole roasted duck served in two servings, so you had the whole duck comes out to the table. It's in this gorgeous piece of silver that, you know, no one can afford to buy anymore. I mean, it tells you how old the restaurant is, because they had gueridons and all these gorgeous, you know, just crystal and silver, but the duck was the best duck I've ever had in my life. And the breast was served first, and just these gorgeous, again, sort of almost like a tranche piece, where it's this sort of cross section of the breast, and the fat was perfectly browned, and you know, the accompaniments were just great fresh vegetables, and then the leg was served in the second dish, and it was a great experience.
So what was the best wine you had on your trip?
Oh my.
Quick answer.
Marcoux 2007 and Magnum. Oh my
Marcoux,
goodness.
The main Marcoux, the Chateauneuf du Pape producer.
Yes.
I mean, wine from the Two Sisters.
Absolutely brilliant from the Two Sisters. It was gorgeous. It was absolutely gorgeous. And that was with, you know, beautiful cooking. The cooking was perfect for the wine. And frankly, made some friends on the trip. And they were amazing people from Munich, Germany. And really, really knowledgeable. The gentleman was really knowledgeable about wine and food and knew a lot of the old winemakers. So it was just what a great trip.
That's Beaugravier, and you must have been in Beaugravier and Mondragon in the south of France.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a great, great wine destination, and also a destination to eat truffles in a very relaxed and warm and almost familial setting.
Exactly.
So when we come back to Take 5, we're going to come off of vacation, and we're going to head into the market, and then we're going to get into five really important American classic dishes as we head towards the July 4th holiday. Welcome back to Take 5, where we have Cindy's mostly back in Baltimore from her vacation, where it sounds like she ate everything in France.
Pretty much.
And drank a little bit of good Chateauneuf du Pape.
It was a great trip. Let's talk about the market, Tony, now that we're really getting the swing, and oh my goodness.
This whole year has not been a swing. That's the thing. I was just, you know, we were just talking about every year being so different, one from the other in the market, and obviously, the weather is so different. I mean, it's, you know, it's a funny thing.
We've had a lot of rain.
They always lead off the news, it seems like, with a teaser on the weather, just so you watch all the way through the news and mm-hmm. and wait for the weather, which is the one thing that everyone's sort of concerned about. If you were a farmer and your living depended on it, this would be a tough year, because we had that, you know, the wet winter, they like.
Okay.
And, but the cool spring and the late flowering on things, definitely tough.
Okay.
Definitely tough. And then the thing that becomes difficult is that every time you watch the evening news or whatever and you see the weather, you see there's that snow rain line that's sort of like north and west of Baltimore and south and east. It's very different. Mm-hmm. And that's true. The Eastern Shore has not been clobbered with a lot of the more sort of violent stuff we've had. And they didn't have the heavy-duty frost that they did north and west. But north and west of the area and a lot of the product that we get for restaurants is all from Carroll County and western Maryland and southern Pennsylvania. And so we've had to start to rely early in the season more and more this year because a lot of the late frosts out that way on product from eastern Baltimore County and eastern Harford County, Cecil County, and the Eastern Shore, and even a couple of farmers in Delaware. So it's a little bit of an unusual year. You got a lot of product that is a little behind what it normally would be. Lettuces, you saw the beautiful lettuces we got last week. It's almost, we started lettuces from farmers locally, like frisée or butter lettuce or red romaine, this kind of stuff. Usually we start that first week of May. By Mother's Day, we're rolling with that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until after Memorial Day. That's very unusual. It has not been that way 13, 14 years since we've had that happen in the spring. Everything's a little behind. Asparagus ran a little bit longer than usual.
Which was great. I appreciate that. That's a benefit of the weather to have the asparagus as long as we did this year.
To have a couple more cool spells to keep it from because when asparagus gets, you know, you always complain if I buy it too long and it gets horseradish.
Yeah, I hate that taste. Right. Well, that's what happens.
She complains bitterly about that,
yes,
folks.
Oh, yes. It's such an ugly thing.
But this year, it's hung on and stayed pretty nice because
we've
had the rains. And it's because the plant hasn't dried out.
You know, it's been fun to do different, you know, several different preps with it, too, because we've had it for the period of time that we have.
But here, immediately, as soon as the weather starts getting warm, everyone starts thinking the tomatoes are coming.
No.
Well, guess what?
They're not, right?
The early tomatoes, yeah. I mean, there are a couple of varieties that will come right after the 4th.
Okay.
And they're fine. You know, the beginning of aromas are fine. But the tomatoes, just like anything else, it's a certain number of days of sun, and they're super, super easy to frost. So you got to get them in the ground, you know, between May 1st and 15th, usually. And then farmers, no matter how hot the place is, they're still going to need 2 months of sun.
Mm-hmm.
And if you haven't had a lot of sun, and here we are another gray week in June,
right?
You know, it's going to be longer than that. So that's why I usually think August 1st, but in certain places, like eastern Baltimore County, where it's warmer and the nights are not as cool, usually think a little quicker. So maybe by July 22nd, 24th, somewhere in there, tomatoes are coming, the real ones, heirloom varieties, the original varieties from the Americas.
Yeah.
Those you're looking at more like the first week of August, which is about 2 weeks later than normal, which is, again, 13, 14 years since that's happened.
Right.
So,
well, we'll see what happens with the rest, you know, as is it going to suddenly get super hot and advance things maybe a little bit more quickly?
Well,
who knows?
Some things that are happening that are really nice are the zucchini flowers are coming now.
Oh,
the little zucchini and summer squash is starting to come
out. Yeah, that's exciting.
And those are inexpensive, will be beautiful this year, abundant this year.
Zucchini and squash are so great when they're really fresh. It is. Yeah. It's just, and the blossoms are so much fun to work with. You know, whether you just, you know, make beignets or fry them very simply or stuff them. There's just so many things you can do with the flowers.
You know what's crazy is we always think of Mediterranean vegetables, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just getting on to start to segue into the American food thing. The four sort of Mediterranean vegetables you always think of are zucchini, eggplant, tomatoes and peppers, right?
Right.
They're all Native American plants.
I know. It's amazing.
and they always come in that sequence. I mean, that's zucchini and the flowers tell you what's coming. Then eggplants come, then tomatoes, and then peppers. It's just literally a matter of how long it takes to grow the stuff. And by the time you get to the middle of August, you've got everything to play with, you know.
And you have corn in there too, because those plants were often planted in the fields with the corn.
Yeah, I mean those five things are really there's your bounty of summertime.
No doubt, absolutely. Oh, I can't wait for corn. That's going to be exciting. I hope it's a good year for corn.
So you say corn, I just think corn makes me think Maryland, growing up here, and makes me think crab cakes.
Definitely. Yeah, we need to talk about some of this great all-American food with such a great American holiday coming up here.
So you and I had discussed talking about like five all-American dishes with the Independence Day holiday coming up. So the first thing we're going to talk about, being in Maryland, are crab cakes.
Yes. How can we not? We love our crab cakes here. And we have such great crab meat. And it's you know, I hope again it'll be a great year for that. And hope for the fishermen it will be a good year for them, a good season. And and everybody will be happy all the way around. You know, I think one of the biggest things with working with crab meat is not to overshadow the flavor of the crab. A lot of people will put something like a pepper with it, you know, or, you know, just all I can say
peppers is peppers tend to dominate any dish they're a
they
part
do.
Of.
So please watch your seasoning. You know, I make our crab cakes are very simple. We put very little breadcrumb in. We use panko or Japanese breadcrumb, which is very light and has almost no flavor. So it's a delicate breading and it's a very little bit. I mean, for a 4 ounce crab cake, I may put a teaspoon of that in, if that, and a little bit of mayonnaise, whole grain mustard. We put a little bit of fresh lemon juice in because, of course, the crab meat likes the lemon, and a drop of Tabasco. And typically, I don't even put salt or pepper in them. They really typically don't need it. And, you know, form your crab cakes, form them, and saute them in a good neutral oil and pop them in the oven. You know, get them nice and brown, pop them in the oven to get them hot through. And there's so many different ways you can accompany them. What do you like to do with crab cakes?
I always see you make the best one I've ever had. And
Thank you. And
growing up here, I had a million different kinds.
Okay.
Some people deep fry them, and some people do all kinds of things to them, and they season the bejesus out of it. And I think what you're saying is exactly right, which is just make it about the crab. It should be delicate and beautiful. And if you get the if you make the cake sort of tall enough, almost like you build it square and then make it round.
Yeah, right.
You know, sort of like a double height hockey puck or something.
Yes.
And get it good and crispy, but not burned on the outside on both sides.
Golden.
Just once one side's brown, then put it in the oven to just get it warm the rest of the way through. But you have that moist, very tender center of it.
Right.
And you have that crispy crust, and that can't
it's
be beat.
So good. So good.
Well, the thing that made me think of crab cakes was corn. And I think my favorite thing is, you know, you have that. There's your, like when crab is actually in season in Maryland, is the same time the corn is actually coming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, to me, those are the two things I always want in the same dish. It's like lima beans are coming, corn is coming.
Yeah,
time to make crab cakes.
So good with crab. Well, and also you could either just roast your corn on the cob. You know, when I like to do it just as it's been done for many years by the Native Americans, where you just roast it in the husk. And if you're not doing it on your grill or outside on an open fire, if you're doing it in your oven, 350 degrees, usually for about 30 to 40 minutes, just watch the tassel. You want to pull those off so that they don't become on fire in your oven.
The tassel, you mean sort of the silky bits that's on the corn.
The silky bit, yeah.
Yeah, please don't burn your house down.
Yeah, leave the husk on. And then once it's done, you just, and the other cool thing about roasting it in the husk is when you go to pull the husk back, it usually pulls most of the silk with it. So it's a much easier way to kind of deal with it.
You always want to wait, right? You want to wait till it's cooled down all the way in the husk, because that's what concentrates the sugars.
Exactly.
And that's where the natural seasoning and the salt and sugars all kind of balance out. So when you just cut that corn off the husk,
it's so good.
It has all the best natural flavor.
Exactly. And then I usually saute it in a little bit of butter with salt and pepper. And then you can add your little bit of boiled lima beans to that. And oh my goodness. Or you could make a sauce from the corn if you want to take that further step. You could, you know, saute an onion, add the roasted corn to that, add some cream or milk or half and half, whichever you prefer.
Make it sort of like a coulis.
Yeah. And you could leave it whole, or you could actually puree it, pop in your blender, puree it, strain it, and that is a gorgeous sauce for a crab cake.
The corn is so naturally sweet. I think that's the thing that I always, when I teach about wine, one of the things I always teach about is what dishes want oak, what dishes don't want oak.
Mm-hmm.
And the two things that always want American Chardonnay with oak, the big, lavish, sort of, you know, buttery, pineapple-y sort of things that we seem to love sometimes, are corn and lobster as well. But if you have corn with your crab dish, and you have some kind of a sauce that has a little bit of strength to it, some presence to it, real old-fashioned remoulade or
yum.
You know, that kind of mustardy, mayonnaise-y, you know, pickly sharp something that to set off that crab. Then you can use something that has that acid, that strength, and that sort of vanilla, oaky driven flavor that we like so much.
When you talked about lobster for a second, I mean, I've made crab cakes with lobster in them, and boy, that's like a double treat.
Well, they have such different flavor.
So good together.
They're sort of a brother and sister in flavor, because the crab meat's so sweet and delicate, and the lobster, then you realize the lobster has a lot deeper voice.
Definitely. So, yeah, I mean, I would do probably 60% crab meat and 40% lobster meat. You want to make sure the lobster's relatively small so the crab cake doesn't break up too much on you. But yeah, I that would be good. And with that Chardonnay, that would be amazing.
Yeah, it's just sort of, like I said, adding a bass note to the song.
So we should probably talk about potato salad, because everybody's going to be
making... Because you
love
potatoes.
Well, I do. And so does America. Potatoes are the most sold vegetable in the United States. That also, is the most eaten thing of all the vegetables, potatoes.
See, and I feel guilty eating potatoes, right?
It's from when the government
in the '80s said something about ketchup being a vegetable.
Oh boy!
I thought the only less legitimate vegetable than ketchup was potatoes, because immediately when you're a little kid, you're thinking, well, like fried potatoes.
Yeah, well.
And then you think, oh my God, I love them. And then the next thing you think is, I eat too many of those. Are bad for me, right?
God.
So how are you going to make a potato salad, Cindy, that's healthy,
well,
that I'm not going to feel guilty
if
about
If I could
it.
Make potato salad the way I wanted to, it would have black winter truffles in it. So since we're in the middle of summer and
almost no calories in truffles.
We won't do it that way.
So barring the truffles,
I can't help myself.
Give me an American potato salad.
Well, I'm from a German-American family. We like vinegar. So I would definitely put either apple cider vinegar or champagne vinegar in with my potatoes.
So what kind of potatoes do you like to use for your potato salad?
You want to use a waxy potato. So Yukon Golds are great, or fingerling potatoes are great. And fingerlings have a higher sugar content, which makes them extremely appealing. And, you know, they're a little bit more expensive and a little bit more involved working with. But a Yukon Gold is perfect. And just make sure you're cooking it in highly salted water. They need a lot of salt.
How salty is highly salted?
You want to feel like it's like the sea. That's salty.
So if you have a 3-quart sauce pot,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to put
quarter of a cup, half a
six
cup.
Six Yukon Golds in there or something like that.
I'd put about half a cup of kosher salt in. I don't work with iodized salt. So.
Well, the point of that, right, is so that you not only cook them through,
mm-hmm.
but not cook them hard, but cook, how do you know when you cook them enough?
Fork tender is what we say. So you just want to put a knife blade in or a fork in, and just you can tell as if you can't get through the potato, you're still undercooked. You don't want it to be so soft that it's going to turn into a mush mass when you're trying to make your salad. You want it to be just tender in the center, and you're going to have carryover cooking, so you want to pull them out right when you feel that they're tender in the center. And
if you cook them with the skins on, mm-hmm. the skins are still intact.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as the skin starts to come off on their own, they're probably
right. That's a good indicator. But
probably getting
done. I would definitely put a knife blade in there. And if you are cooking them with the skin on, I would peel them after that. So you can use a clean kitchen towel to pull that off, or you can use your hands.
Just rub
the skin off, and then cut them into quarters or however big the potatoes are. You want just a nice big piece of potato, and it's nice to dress them while they're still warm. I think that's really kind of they're going to absorb that vinegar. And
so you're talking about a potato salad that's kind of a la minute.
Yes.
In other words, you're doing it, you're cooking it, and it's going to by the time it cools, by the time it gets dressed, seasoned, and cools to room temperature, it's on the table, but it's still real super tender.
Definitely.
And the seasoning is already done in the water.
Definitely. So, yeah, you could add, I have chives growing in my garden at my house, so I would finely chop some chives and add it at the end, so you can kind of pick your oil. Do you want it to be more of a neutral oil, so you're using corn or peanut, or do you want some of that rich flavor of extra virgin olive oil? Personally, I would use both. I would use a little bit of corn and a little bit of extra virgin, because extra virgin might actually overpower, and a little bit of salt, freshly ground pepper, and chives. And if you want, you could go the way of adding a little bit of whole grain mustard, or you could add a little bit of crispy bacon.
Yeah, that bacon sounds like a German girl tactic right there, for sure.
I think it's a good way to go. But there's so many different things you could do with potato salad, especially with all the local product that we have coming in.
Right now, the fava beans are gorgeous right now.
That would be so good.
And I will admit, I think I like fava beans better just raw out of the husk than I do cooking them in any way.
Interesting.
The first time I ever had them like that, I was at a winery in the Chianti zone and standing on this huge old stone terrace from the 1300s. And they had them just in the pods, because it has a husk inside of the pod,
mm-hmm.
these big crazy things. And they had them sitting out in a big thing of coarse salt. And they give you a glass of vernaccia, the white wine from that area.
Very good.
And it's okay, we're done the tasting. We'll just socialize now. And I'm watching this 90-year-old grandmother grab these things and just peel the thing in a second and take all the husks from the inside and then pop the sort of almost like nuts, the favas, out of the husks into her mouth.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay. And then put her finger in the salt and lick it. It was the craziest thing.
Yeah, I've never seen anyone do that. That's cool.
And then a little bit of vernaccia. It's this is the coolest thing. But The nutty flavor of the favas on their own.
Yeah, oh, they're so good. I love them.
You could dress them and make a you know, a little bit of, like I was talking about with the rosemary, mm-hmm. in a mortar and pestle, a little bit of if you use a microplane on a lemon peel, mm-hmm. for a little bit of the lemon oil, extra virgin olive oil, the rosemary, a little coarse salt there, a little bit of black pepper or pink peppercorn if you like that little bit different flavor, and a drop or two of very old vinegar and make in the mortar and pestle almost like a vinaigrette. Dress the favas with that, and then dress the potatoes with the favas with that.
That sounds
dressing
really
would be pretty terrific.
That's a good twist.
A fun thing to do with, mm-hmm. and it always makes me think of wines in that area, whether it's like really fresh young Sangiovese or that sort of like nutty, flowery Vernaccia that they grow near San Gimignano.
I'm afraid I would have to stand there and eat that and drink that wine outside. That just sounds so good.
This winery, I Fabri, has. It's been there since the 1300s and has a terrace that like faces La Mole alongside some of their terrace vineyards. It's the highest vineyard site in the Chianti zone. And sort of one of the secrets in that area is like the higher you go, it's harder to ripen, but the aromatics are better. So if you get a really long season, like 2007 is a great Chianti season. For these wines from that area, like Fontori or La Mole or Sodis San Nicolo, those guys all made beautiful, super aromatic wines that'll live a long time.
That's great.
All right, Sin, how about one last twist on potato salad?
All right, I want to add a couple of different ideas. So if you added a little bit of grilled andouille sausage to your potato salad, you'd have a little flavor of the South.
Just to lighten it up.
Which would be awfully fun, yes.
And this is twice you've got pork product in your potato salad.
And I can't help it. And, you know, it just comes naturally for me. And then I'm going to add, this may seem a little weird, but a little bit of fresh lavender oil. And I just think that would perfume it up and make it very pretty. And also...
Well, the skins of cooked potatoes, especially fingerlings, have an amazing aroma. So if you kept those on there and dressed it with the lavender oil...
Exactly. I think it would be really pretty. And you could use some of the flowers to garnish the bowl if you're mm-hmm. doing, say, a buffet for a family. And also, I think just a little bit of a ripe olive in there, chopped up, not a whole lot added to it, but it would just add, if it's a really good olive, not something out of a can, but, you know, a Niçoise olive or a Tagliacci olive, something really, really traditional, and just put that in there, and I think it would be very, very pretty.
Something just sort of bitter and fruity.
Right, and you just get that spice from the andouille, and that's good seasoning, too. It will also color your potato salad because of the amount of paprika and pepper that's in the andouille sausage. So it'll give it a little bit of a pink tone. Fun stuff.
Nice tone.
Yes.
So when we come back to Take Five, we've got three more American classics to play with. Welcome back to Take Five. And all right, Cindy Lou, this is the most important moment of the program.
Because we're going to talk about fried chicken?
That is correct.
All right.
I think about fried chicken at least 5 days a week. I want to eat fried chicken at least 5 times a week.
Wouldn't it be so nice if you came home from work and there was a plate of fried chicken on the counter and you could just go over there and eat it? Somebody had made it for you.
The food fantasy of my youth was going to my great-grandmother's, and dinner was Saturday afternoon, 3 o'clock, and to find out what she had made. And if it was hot enough, it was a pretty good bet that she had made fried chicken in the morning, and then it was sitting on the back of the stove.
Nice.
You know, and she'd made pickles, and she'd made greens. And she would just like steam a little bit of rice, and you know, mm-hmm. and that was going to be supper. And but her fried chicken was great. And when she passed away, she, you know, my big inheritance from her was her fried chicken pan, which weighed about 35 pounds.
That's a good thing.
Was an iron skillet that she got when she got married in 1909.
Very good, very very good.
So, but she's not around. And your fried chicken is the best I've had since then. So, how do you make yours?
I think one of the best parts of the fried chicken is that it's tender, and the reason for that is we marinate it in buttermilk, and the acid in the buttermilk helps to create that tender chicken. So we make a paste with buttermilk, flour, salt, and pepper, and that's what the chicken actually sits in. And we only sit it in there for a couple of hours. It doesn't, not overnight, it doesn't need to be in there that long, but you could certainly do it that morning if you're cooking later on in the evening.
So buttermilk to tenderize it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, before that, decisions that you make about the chicken, where you source it, how you season it, how you cut it up. Do you keep the skin? You know, what are you using?
I use this is a boneless chicken breast, and we use an air chilled chicken, which is going to be one of the best tasting chickens. And but you can certainly fry chicken with the bone in, or fry the legs and the thighs. I mean, all those, the dark meat is delicious and really probably tastes better than the breast meat does. You know, either way, you're still going to go into that, make that paste with the buttermilk. And then the next step is right before you go to fry. And of course, I warn you, if you're deep frying, to be very, very careful. It is one of the worst ways to get burned in a kitchen by splattered fat. And we fry at about 325 degrees. So if you do have a countertop fryer, just have it at that temperature. And I usually do it in two batches. We cook it, we sort of pre-cook it, and then let it rest for a couple of minutes, and then drop it back down again so that the breading doesn't get too dark.
So you kind of form the crust and let it
rest, and then drop it back down, especially if it's a breast. If it's a big piece of meat, it does take almost 7 minutes for it to fry properly from start to finish.
When you let it rest in between, you're also taking advantage of that first wave of carryover cooking.
Exactly.
Without browning the crust anymore.
Exactly. So that internal heat is continuing to cook the chicken. And then once you've got it in that batter, then your breading procedure is cornmeal, all-purpose flour, and we put salt, a little bit of black pepper, and cayenne pepper in that. And that's, you know, you go from your marinade or your paste to that flour mixture. And again, I think cornmeal and all-purpose flour, I would say probably, you know, 60% flour, 40% cornmeal. And I also put sesame seeds in there, and that just obviously gives it an inherently nutty taste. And
I think it makes the cornmeal taste better. It just kind of shows off. It kind of shows off how naturally sweet the cornmeal is by having that little bit of punch of flavor.
Yeah, the sesame seeds are really important. And I think the level of cayenne and black pepper is very important. You know, up to you, as always. Do you like things spicy? Then put more cayenne. If you don't like it spicy, just put a little pinch in. But yeah, just roast, then drop it in the fryer, and you're off to goodness, basically.
I guess whenever, the other thing I think about with fried chicken, besides yours is great, is that I love other fried things with it. So whether it's, like during this time of the year, the little baby zucchini.
Oh, yes.
You know, slices of those, battered up in a super light batter, some, you know, with sparkling water or sparkling wine, or mm-hmm. Zucchini flowers.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
a nice
garnish. A big plate of fried chicken with fried zucchini and zucchini flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of no sauce, just lots of fresh lemon to squeeze on it.
There you go. Also, Vidalia onion beignets. That's another one of my favorites. I mean, well, I could just sit there and eat a bowl of Vidalia onion beignets, but that's a nice one too because they're crunchy, like the zucchini will be. And, that's a nice accompaniment. And this is a time of the year for good Vidalia onions.
What do you like on the table with fried chicken?
Biscuits and cornbread. So it's just the heaviest meal in the whole world. No, again, I think the sweet corn comes in.
That's why you have it at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so you can digest it the rest of the day.
Right. Local green beans, any of our local vegetables would be, you know, great with it.
Yeah. Some kind of sharp salad, whether it's dandelion or rocket or
arugula,
or something.
Yeah, exactly. It would be, or watercress. A watercress salad would be great with it. Anything, as you say, anything that's got a little bit of spiciness to it would help to cut the richness of the fried chicken.
It might be more all-American to drink beer with it, but I never want beer with fried chicken. It always just feels like the heaviest thing, especially if I'm having biscuits.
Right.
Especially biscuits made with lard or cornbread along with it.
What would you like to drink with it then?
Either some kind of white wine with good acidity and mm-hmm. and big presence. You know, that's kind of down in Santa Barbara. If we're talking about American stuff, down in Santa Barbara, they're growing Roussan, which is one of the Rhone Valley grapes. That makes big, rich white. Honestly, a red Zinfandel that's not too alcoholic or not too tannic. You know, one of these Dry Creek Valley ones that are very sort of like spicy, snappy, almost more like the real Primitivo that those grapes are derived from the south of Italy. Something that, you know, juicy, snappy, spicy, great to have with that. Maybe sounds ridiculous, but sparkling wine is pretty darn fun with it.
Oh, that doesn't sound ridiculous to me. It seems like a good idea.
Argyle Winery up in Oregon makes terrific sparkling wine, champagne style.
Very good.
Except he lets the grapes ripen a little more than they do in champagne, so you get big body and big mousse. And so, you know, sort of like for all those big, rich flavors on the table.
Yeah, that sounds great for the chicken.
And it has good Argyle. It has good acidity.
Okay, cool.
You know, so it'll cut through it, but it's a little, it's
And what's the grape in the Argyle?
Mostly Chardonnay. Chardonnay and Pinot Blanc.
Great.
There's a little Pinot Noir in there as well, but
is that pretty available? Will people have a hard time finding that or not?
It's not in every sort of grocery store sort of place, but it's out there. Argyle is one of the 2-3 best wineries in Oregon, especially for just overall quality. The one last thing I'll say about fried chicken is that I've never seen more consumed by a small group of people than at Ms. Wilk's boarding house.
Oh my goodness!
The sort of I don't know. Very iconic restaurant in Savannah, Georgia,
mm-hmm.
Where Peter Keck and Tim Walker and I had what looked like piles of carcasses going.
Yeah,
alongside of us a long time ago at the table. That was remarkable.
I can't believe that anyone could eat as much food as you all did at that restaurant.
It was the killing fields.
Talk about family style. That was like craziness. It was very, very good food.
It was very important.
Ms. Wilk's Boarding House in
Savannah. We were having like a very spiritual moment with the chicken.
It was spiritual, all right.
I've never seen, and Tim's great, great, great big guy, at least 100% larger than I am, if not substantially more.
But I think you out-ate him.
I think Peter and I both did, and Peter's a smaller guy than I am.
Yep.
So
you all did pretty well. The girls were just kind of sitting there awe.
The girls were mostly in horror, I think, not all. You're very
like, really?
Kind.
Are you still eating? How can you do that?
We're going to leave and disown any knowledge of you. So, all right, so tell me about mac and cheese, Cindy Lou. Speaking of Ms. Wilkes, we had mac and cheese there, but it's not like yours.
No, well, that's because I make mine with cream, but I actually want to talk about my mother's. Because my mother has a good way of making it that makes it very easy.
Good,
and,
good.
You know, it's the process of cooking the macaroni. So you boil it off in salted water. Again, you have a starch, so you want the water to be quite salty so it absorbs that good flavor. And then drain it and cool it down. And then go into a casserole dish, and it should be a high-sided casserole dish. You don't want a Pyrex dish, a flat dish. And it's milk, cheddar cheese, and salt and pepper. And you just cover it, you know, put as much cheese as you like. I'd say probably for, maybe for 5 people, you'd probably want a cup of good cheddar and cover it with the milk and season it well and pop it in the oven. And that's the end of the story. I mean, it's very simple to make, and it's kind of a nice thing because you can kind of forget about it. When I make mine,
Does your mom brown it?
It does eventually brown. And you can do that. You can just crank up your oven at the end of the process to get a little bit of color on top.
Get a little sort of bubble.
I would cook it at probably 350 and then maybe crank it up. It depends on your oven, but maybe crank it up to 400 or 425 for the last few minutes of the process. And when I make mine, I, again, just blanch it. I blanch a 1-pound box of DiCecco macaroni for 6 minutes. So water comes up to a boil, 6 minutes of cooking, drain it, cool it down. And now it's ready for, I reduce a little bit of cream down with a little bit of reduced chicken stock. And then I add some sort of cheese that I have from England, typically, like the Keen's cheddar, which is just this really brilliant piece of cheese and has almost sort of a beautiful, musty, cavey tone to it. The cheese is sort of rich and vegetal, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have some sense of it. A lot of the farmstead cheeses we get from England right now, from the UK in general, but from England are all, you have a sense of this is from the animal, it was made fresh, this is the diet the animal ate,
absolutely.
This is how it was raised up in a cave, and
and
it comes to you. It's very, very real flavors. It makes a giant difference in
cooking. It really does. It makes something that, you know, we can all say, you know, macaroni and cheese could be the simplest of things. This really elevates it and doesn't make it something crazy, but it makes it something really, really good because
of
the tone
flavor,
of the
rich flavors.
Right, and if you have a good bit of reduced chicken stock in there, I mean, if I use a quarter of cream for a box of macaroni, 1-pound box, and I probably put 2 ounces of really reduced chicken stock in there, which just gives it, again, that depth, and I put about a cup of the Keen's cheddar in, and then I put salt in, and I feel like I've said mustard 5 times on this show, but I put a couple tablespoons of whole grain mustard in, and that gives you acid balance as well. So the cheese will have a level of acidity to it, and the mustard, and that balances it out. And
as rich as that is that its own dish? I mean, if you're actually like, if you're going to make it in a gratin dish for like a dinner party, this like, you know, serious Cindy Lou mac and cheese sort of business. What do you serve with that? It's got to be like some...
I typically serve duck confit with it, and it needs
some
sort of...
with like no sauce or something.
Right.
Yeah.
It needs some sort of meat with it because it's so rich that it actually becomes a bit much if you don't have something else breaking it up. So rabbit confit or duck confit or, I mean, quite frankly, a great piece of beef. would, you know, great piece of beef tenderloin or a ribeye grilled.
I mean, I like that. I love the idea of the duck confit.
Yeah, it's so good on top, and it's picked meat, and it's easy to eat.
Or some other kind of game bird. It could be guinea fowl or something like
right,
that.
Right, exactly. But, yeah, it's that's the rich one.
The other thing with that is the wine that you want for it. You think, oh, it's, you know, delicate cheeses. What? You want to put a red wine, and it's actually something pretty country that you kind of want to put with it. You remember the Cru Beaujolais from Chateau Thivan, the Côte de Bouilly, that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
Or Morgon. It's a red wine that's medium body. You think of Beaujolais as being light because everyone thinks of Beaujolais Nouveau. The Cru Beaujolais, especially 9 and 10 and 11 vintages, are all strong years. The wines are not light. The wines are the wines from good growers are medium bodied with decent tannin and punchy fruit and have a very dark note of the granite soil that they come from.
Great.
Or the volcanic soil that they come from. That's about the only thing that's going to sort of clean that up properly for you.
I love those wines. Those wines really are really beautiful.
Well, they're beautiful for food. I mean, that's.
Oh, I can definitely see those two things together for sure.
Yeah,
just
no
be
question.
Gorgeous.
So, all right, now you got me completely filled up on fried chicken and the richest macaroni and cheese in the world.
And potato salad.
And potato salad.
I didn't say all these things went together.
And crab cakes.
I just said.
So clearly, I need, before the coma that I'm going to drop into.
Oh, boy.
I need a slice of pie.
Yes,
because
you do.
The all-time American thing to do is like go to the diner, sit at the counter, right? And you point to the pie that you want a slice of. So, and then you point to the pie and you get the slice and the fruit is either not fresh or not cooked in a nice way or the crust is not nice.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start with the crust. So a pie crust that I'm actually going to like.
Pâté sucré, which is a sweet pie dough. And it's inexpensive to make, so
the end goal of this kind of a pie crust is this a flaky something? Is this like a cookie crust?
It's actually a cookie crust.
Okay.
So it really it's going to be.
So you're not chasing the flaky. It's a
cookie
crust.
Flaky. It's going to be a harder crust exactly, and you need to make it that day. And it's I'll give you the recipe. It's 1 1/4 cups of all-purpose flour, 8 tablespoons of butter, which needs to be diced into small dice, and it needs to be soft. A cup of 10x sugar, a pinch of salt, and 2 whole eggs, medium in size.
So the butter soft means you got to take it out like an hour ahead or something
exactly.
like that.
And you don't want it to be at all melting, so don't go too far with that softness. But yeah, you do not want it to be too firm. And you make a well, and you put all of the ingredients in the center except for the eggs, and you begin to pull things together with your hands. And if you've done this on your countertop, like at work, I would put a piece of parchment paper down and put my flour, sifted flour, onto the parchment paper, make a little well in the center, put your ingredients in except for the eggs, start to work it, and then add the whole eggs in the center as well. And you're just pulling everything together. What you don't want to do is overwork the starches, the glutens in the flour. So you want to pull it together with your fingers. You want to do it pretty quickly. And then you just want to kind of knead the whole thing like twice.
So what you have is almost like when you're a little kid and you're at the beach and you're going to make sandcastles and you sprinkle your first water and you're making little like, you know, you're making cookie dough essentially.
Yeah,
so it should just be little crumbles of stuff, right?
Yeah.
Sort of a little bit moist, but it's little crumbles of fat that has all the flour on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're going to kind of knead into a form.
Yes.
Because the lightness comes from that fat melting, creating those little pockets between all the flour, and the flour stiffens up, right?
Exactly. And then you just roll, you know, you want it to rest, so you wrap it in plastic wrap, let it rest for an hour. And then you roll it out, and it is a little bit of a stickier dough, so you're going to want to have flour on your pin, flour on your rolling pin, flour on your table, and, you know, not excessive because you don't want to ruin the dough, but it is a little sticky so because of the quantity of sugar in it. And roll it out nice and thin, dock it, put it in, roll it into your pie pan and dock it, and you want to blind bake it, which means you have to put some sort of paper, again, parchment paper is preferable, and some sort of dried bean in. That will keep it from rising, falling, doing whatever it can do without that. Blind bake it, get it until it's just lightly cooked. You know, you want it to form and be sort of almost pale gold,
mm-hmm.
and then you can make your pie.
And so you're just beginning to cook, and then you can actually add your filling.
Yes.
And a crumble top is probably the easiest thing to do.
Yeah.
With a little more of that dough, if you don't want to do the, you know, some kind of a lattice crust or any kind of madness like that.
Mm-hmm.
Favorite fillings? Because we've got all kinds of summer fruit coming up.
Oh, my. I mean, I love
cherries right now.
I love cherries. Yeah, cherries. And see, I like custard in mine. So, I mean, of course. Now, you don't have to put the custard in.
Cindy Lou's Dairy Farm opens next week.
You could just put the fruit in, rolled in sugar, if it needs it. It may not need it. And
you know me,
of,
I'm going to add booze to it. So, like the cherries, I'm going to put a little grappa, and fresh basil with the cherries or something. And
well,
put
for me,
there.
It would be brandy. And yeah, just knock the fruit in and bake it off a little bit of flour tossed in with really wet fruit, and that's all you need. Bake it at 325 degrees, and you have pie.
Sounds like beautiful stuff. All right, so your five takeaways today, the five things that you have to have again or you're going to have to make immediately as soon as you leave the program.
Crab cakes, potato salad, fried chicken, macaroni and cheese, and some sort of pie.
I thought you were going to say that you're going to immediately get on a plane and go to Benoit and get escargot.
Oh, well, there's that, too.
Well, thanks so much for listening. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Cindy Wolf.
And we hope that you have a terrific holiday and you get a great vacation, like Cindy did.
Mm-hmm.
And I look forward to mine. If you have questions or topics you want us to talk about, please send an email to foremanwolf, F-O-R-E-M-A-N-W-O-L-F, @WYPR.org. And have a great holiday.
Absolutely. Happy 4th to everyone.